Right then, brethren, we spent many weeks now looking at the topic of prophecy, as it might apply to our end times, and we're still on that theme at the moment. Last week, if you recollect that far back in time, we were looking at the book of Revelation. We had been through Revelation 17 in some detail, so today as our refresh, we'll go through Revelation 17 again, but just hitting the high points, just a few verses here and there, just to get back to speed before we move on to Revelation 18. So if you want to open your Bibles at Revelation 17, having spent all last week, and I think even perhaps a wee bit the week before on Revelation 17, it should be fairly well understood, at least the basics, if not the details. And I'll say again, probably at least twice today, what we can do, all of us, is we can become very familiar with the narrative. You know, what the Apostle John actually wrote, what he wrote, what he said he heard, what he saw. That part, there can't be much debate over. But of course, when it comes to, but what does that mean here in the 21st century or something? Well, that becomes a bit harder. We have to concede that very often, once we move away from the actual words of Scripture, we're getting into some speculation. We're trying to be responsible with our speculation and say, let's make sure there's plenty of evidence, plenty of Scriptures, that things do sort of stack up and not just wander off on some sort of fantasy tale. Hopefully we're doing that, but nonetheless, as we depart from Scripture, there's got to be some element of that looks like it might mean this. So let's not get too dogmatic about what it might mean. As time progresses, as we come to the fulfillment in real life of these Scriptures, it will become really very evident how close we were or perhaps weren't. So Revelation 17, if you got there, let's kick off in verse 1. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters." So Revelation 17, we get much of a description about this great harlot, this great whore. And chapter 18, which we'll come to later today, we see the actual judgment being brought on the great harlot. So chapter 17 is giving us a background description and then something about the scarlet beast that she rides. And this great harlot, it says, sits on many waters. Verse 15 tells us the waters are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. So this great harlot, this woman, which I think we'll accept means false religion, so a harlot, has an international reach. Many different countries, many different languages. Verse 2, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, the inhabitants of the earth are made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Verse 3, so he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, or the Greek desert, or lonely place, and there I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. And we saw that this woman, who can be found in the desert or lonely place or wilderness, is actually also a city. Notice verse 18. The woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. This great city has international connections, and it's a great city. And of course, the question we were asking last week was, could this be Rome? Might it be perhaps New York? Could it be ancient Babylon? Or the suggestion I put forward was, might it be Mecca in Saudi Arabia? Mecca, I suggested, was potentially a very good fit, particularly if we're thinking of the Islamic Empire being resurrected in these latter days, because Mecca is actually the birthplace of Islam. It is the home of Islam. It is the holy city of 1.67 billion Muslims. It is the birthplace of Muhammad. All Muslims are supposed to pray five times a day, pointing towards Mecca. At least once in their lives, all Muslims, if they are healthy enough and got the money, are supposed to make a pilgrimage to Mecca. And in Mecca, there is something called the Kaaba, K-A-A-B-A, which appears to be some sort of black meteorite, which is virtually worshipped by the Muslims. You'll see them reaching out and touching it, caressing it, kissing it. So, Mecca is the heart, the soul of Islam. And Islam, we've said before, is the religion which contains the spirit of Antichrist, since it denies that God is a father, denies that Jesus is the Son of God, denies that Jesus actually died, was buried, was resurrected. Therefore, Jesus is no Savior. God is no Father. Well, that's the belief, the teaching of 1.67 billion people, and it originates in Mecca. So therefore, Mecca has, quite a strong fit, but we'll see later if it sort of continues to fit other scriptures we'll come to later, down to verse 5. On her forehead, a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. So this great city, this harlot, has a name, Mystery Babylon. So that's really not necessarily pointing at the original Babylon. This is a mystery version of Babylon. The mother of harlots, we said last week, in the Middle East, an expression, for example, one popularized by Saddam Hussein when he talked about the mother of all battles, was coming up against the USA and his allies. The mother of just means the greatest. So the harlot is the greatest of harlots, the greatest of abominable religions. Quite easy, I think, to pin that on Islam. Verse 6, I saw the woman, the great city, the false religion, drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And, of course, Islam, I think we'll mention this later. In the Middle East, in most Islamic countries, Christianity, by any shape or form, is virtually extinct. Okay, verses 9 and 10. Talking now about the scarlet beast, it says, here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads on the beast are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And, of course, we had this discussion about, is that Rome, the city on seven hills? No, it's seven mountains, not hills. And in any event, you know, Jerusalem is on seven hills. Mecca is on seven hills. San Francisco is on seven hills. There's plenty of places on seven hills. It's not talking about hills. It's talking about mountains, and mountains symbolize in the Bible kingdoms. Kings are kingdoms. And it tells us that the next verse, verse 10, they are also seven kings or seven kingdoms. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. When he comes, he must continue a short time. Well, this could be helpful, because here John says one of them actually is, although five are now fallen. And we said, if we interpret this as what was in existence when John was writing the book of Revelation, John was writing around about, 90 AD, whilst on the island of Patmos in the Mediterranean. And John says, one of the kingdoms is, the sixth kingdom is. Five are fallen, one exists right now, and there's another one yet to come. Well, the one that existed in John's day was the Roman Empire. Fairly straightforward. So that should be fairly helpful. Okay, that's the sixth one, the Roman Empire. The five that were fallen already, whose time had sort of come and gone, we suggested could be Egypt, famous for trying to exterminate God's people in the days of the pharaohs, and when they threw the young boys into the Nile to drown them and enslaved God's people. Then Assyria, then Babylon, then Persia, then Greece. All five had ruled or conquered various parts of the Holy Land, often including Jerusalem. The sixth was Rome, and one more was yet to come from John's perspective, sometime after John. And we said a possibility, one that sort of fits the rest of the context of the scriptures we looked at, that could well be the Islamic empire of the Ottomans, the Ottoman Islamic Caliphate. That ran from 1453 right up to 1924, or thereabouts, when it suffered a deadly wound. Just after World War I, they were on the wrong side of that particular World War. And 1453 is when the Eastern Europe, the Eastern Roman Empire, was finally defeated, and Constantinople, the capital of the Roman Empire, was invaded by the Muslims. So hence, you know, Rome, in a sense, lingered, at least the Eastern Roman Empire, right up to 1453, the sixth of these mountains. Okay. Then we said last week, the deadly wound appears then to be healed sometime in our day. And a restored Islamic empire appears likely ahead of us, with a powerful, charismatic leader to whom all Muslims in any country in the whole world will give their allegiance, whom they will obey. He will be their spiritual leader and their political leader, the caliph, a man who will potentially use signs and wonders to convince the doubters. And this restored empire will be actually the eighth mountain, but will be obviously one of the preceding seven. We read that in verse 11. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, and yet is of the seven, and is going eventually to perdition or destruction. Well, that sounds a bit confusing. It's the eighth, it's of the seven. Well, I think all that means really is there are only really seven, but one of them, one of the seven, reappears as an eighth empire in this long list of empires. And my suggestion was that eighth empire is the healed seventh empire, the Islamic empire. And that's what we might see shortly ahead of us with its new world leader. Dropping down to verse 12. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who receive no kingdom as yet, but receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind and will give their power and authority to the beast. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. So here's 10 Islamic countries which unite together with the beast, share their power, and all of them are found fighting the Lord Jesus Christ at his return, which tells us the time here. It's the end time. It's the end of the end time, right up to the end time. Then notice verse 16. And the ten horns which you saw on the beast will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh and burn her with fire. So this might sound a bit surprising. If this harlot, this great city, is Mecca, the heart and soul of Islam, does this really suggest that 10 Islamic countries united with the beast will actually turn on Mecca, turn on Saudi Arabia, and amongst other things, burn her with fire. That might well be, you know, modern weaponry, missiles, possibly even small nuclear weapons to obliterate and burn with fire. Is that plausible? The answer is, yeah, it's plausible because it's happened before. A lot of Muslims actually don't like Arabian supremacy, and particularly don't like Saudi Arabia, whom they believe is apostate in terms of the pure Islam, and some of them hate its decadence, its opulence, its playboy royals. So yeah, it's just, and of course they've been invaded in the past. Turkey, when it was the Ottoman Empire, shelled Mecca and actually managed to hit the Kaaba stone, or the Kaaba. So yeah, it's happened in the past, and this says it will happen again, that many Islamic countries will turn against the women, which I'm suggesting could well be Mecca. Okay, that's just a recap of chapter 17, where we were last week, so we'll move on now to chapter 18, which gives us the actual judgment, describes the final destruction of the harlot. So the previous chapter was just background, who she is, a few hints as to where we might expect to look for her, you know, Rome, New York, or where? Well, Mecca certainly looks extremely plausible, and I think that's largely going to be backed up as we go through chapter 18, which gives us the details of her ultimate destruction. So let's read through verses 1 to 10. Then we'll go back and sort of unpack some of these verses. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become a habitation of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. Pretty dreadful outcome. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Render to her just as she rendered to you, and repay her double according to her works. In the cup which she has mixed, mix for her double. In the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow. For she says in her heart, I sit as queen, and am no widow, and will not see sorrow. Therefore her plagues will come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she will be utterly burned with fire. For strong is the Lord God who judges her. And the kings of the earth, who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her, will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, Alas, alas, that great city, Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. So that's total destruction of this great city, this great harlot. But we've seen here she's referred to by the name of Babylon. Babylon, the great city. Okay, the question I guess will arise for the umpteenth time. Is this city Rome? Is this city New York? Is this city Mecca? as I've been suggesting. Well, let's go back and look at the verses, sort of one by one. Verse 2, first of all, it tells us here, Babylon the Great is fallen. It's been destroyed. It's now a habitation for demons, foul spirits. And actually, interestingly, it does mention here, as a complete aside, nothing to do with the topic, it does mention a cage for every unclean bird. Well, that's, to me, interesting in the sense of, you know, so many people say that nothing's unclean any longer, that, you know, Jesus made everything clean. I saw one quite well-known Protestant teacher this week who mentioned that he says, of course, in Mark 7:19, Jesus declared all meats to be clean. Now, of course, he did nothing of the sort, but that's a comment you'll find. Well, if that were the case, if everything is now clean, how come at the very end, the end of this age, that this angel says there are unclean birds? They can't be, can there, if Jesus made everything clean? Or the angel, maybe he's not so clever after all. Maybe he's a false angel, doesn't understand the truth. Yeah. Well, the answer is things were clean and unclean in Noah's day. You know, when he went into the ark, he took some clean and some unclean. They were clean and unclean in Jesus' day, and they're still clean and unclean today, and they'll be unclean and clean tomorrow. So, anyway, that's by the by. Just saying that, you know, this city is fallen. It's destroyed. Look at verse 3. All the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth. This is international. Have committed fornication. There have been illicit relationships between many nations, many countries, many leaders. I guess that's going to be, in our language today, presidents, prime ministers, perhaps the CEOs of major international corporations who have entered into relationships, arrangements, agreements, contracts for this harlot's wine, which has enabled various parties to, it says at the end of verse 3, to become rich through the abundance of her luxury. Now, abundance of luxury, the Weymouth New Testament translates that as excessive luxury. And I'm going to suggest for now that the wine we're talking about here is the liquid that you find all across the Persian Gulf, which has empowered Saudi Arabia, other Islamic countries, and many countries in the world to become wealthy and economically strong, which is, of course, oil. The oil from the Middle East, the oil from Saudi Arabia, and other countries around there. The oil makes the world go round. And how many, you can see plenty of photographs if you look, of various Saudi royals being treated to red carpet arrivals at the White House, at number 10 Downing Street, in Japan, in Europe, because all the kings of the earth, all the CEOs, all the presidents need to keep pretty close to Saudi Arabia. It might be a case where human rights are very low, where people can be beheaded, where people can be actually treated as almost subhumans and slaves, but we need the oil. We must be very careful around the Saudis and other Islamic states over there. We don't want to offend them because we need the oil. The oil gives us our economies, helps us to be prosperous, and that's very important. Let's just have to tolerate some of the medieval approaches of these Saudis of Mecca. And that's, I think, largely what this verse is getting at. The sometimes really quite disgusting arrangements entered into to get the oil, the things that people close their eyes to get the oil. Dropping down to verse 4, it says, "And I heard another voice from heaven," another angel, I guess, "saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues," her destruction. You don't want to be there when she's destroyed, so get out. "If you stay there, my people, God's people, you will be either contaminated by the way of life. You might, you know, share in her sins. Or if you stay there, you may end up being destroyed in her destruction." Well, okay, I get that. But the question would be then, well, who are these people? Who, if this is Mecca, Saudi Arabia, an Islamic country, what are God's people doing there? You know, presumably, it wouldn't be God's people entering Mecca. It wouldn't be, you know, Christians of all shapes and sizes entering Saudi Arabia, would it? Why would you do that? They wouldn't want you, and you wouldn't want to be there. But this is right at the end time, we can see. This is about the time of the destruction of the woman, the great city. She's about to be destroyed. So my conclusion here is this is quite likely referring to those who have become converted in these last days in Saudi Arabia, in Mecca and its environs. This is people who are now God's people who were not before. Because like I say, I don't think you'd have entered it willingly, at least, if you're a Christian. But if you become a Christian whilst there, if you're a Muslim, for example, who is converted, then of course I think that warning now is to you, get out of there. The destruction is imminent. Get out, get out, get out. Would there be conversions at the end time? I think the answer is yes, quite likely. Because don't forget the two witnesses will have been proclaiming the truth very powerfully for up to 3.5 years. And the whole world will have heard them, particularly, I imagine, those in the Middle East. And don't forget also that there's an angel, the third angel, who proclaims the everlasting gospel, mentioned in Revelation 14. So I think there will be plenty of warnings, plenty of truth available for those who want to accept it, including those of a Muslim background. If you hold your place there, but turn to Revelation 7, let's read verses 9 to 15. Revelation chapter 7. Revelation 7, beginning verses, read verses 9 and 10. "After these things I looked," says John, "and behold, a great multitude, which no one could number, of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, saying, salvation belongs to our God, who sits on the throne, and to the Lamb." So here's a great multitude who come from all nations, all tribes, all peoples, and therefore that could certainly include the tribes and peoples of, let's say, Saudi Arabia, plus other Islamic countries. So it's talking of people from various backgrounds, but where do they come from? You know, who exactly are these? This great multitude. I'll look at verses 13 to 15. "Then one of the elders answered, saying to me, who are these arrayed in white robes? Where did they come from?" Good question. And John says, "Sir, you know." I'm sure I don't. "So he said to me, these are the ones who come out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple, And he who sits on the throne will dwell among them. So the great multitude from every tribe and tongue are those who have come out of the great tribulation. And I'm pretty sure that a number of people, perhaps a significant minority, perhaps even more than that, of people living in Islamic countries are going to recognize at some point that, you know what, the Quran, the ideas of Muhammad, the way of life that we live in our country, it does not stack up. And now that I'm hearing the gospel, the truth from these two guys in Jerusalem, from this angel or whatever it is that proclaims the everlasting gospel, and perhaps from others out there, you know, preaching in every nation, that some are going to say, ooh, I think I realize that Muhammad was not God's prophet. So many are going to come to the truth out of the great tribulation. And I suspect, if we move back to Revelation 18, that's what we're referring to here. A number of people who are going to respond to the truth and are now being told, the end is nigh, you need to get on your bicycle and pedal out of here. Toot sweet.
Toot sweet.
Get out. The time is now. And that's the warning, is to escape before, you know, you're caught up in the great burning of this city. As an aside again, although we know that Islam is the fastest growing religion on the earth, which it is, there are quite a number of reports of a large number of former Muslims today actually leaving Islam and being converted to various Christian churches. That's right now. There's quite a few reports coming out of Iran, Saudi Arabia, other countries just saying, of course, it's not easy for these people. If you leave Islam, then you become subject to the death penalty. But despite that, many people are leaving Islam today. And I think when you get to the end time and through the tribulation and it all heats up, this verse to me implies there'll be a fair number of people, even around the area of Mecca, the heart of Islam, who will be converts and now be instructed to leave. Okay, let's go back to Revelation 18 and just look at verse 2 again. It tells us here in verse 2 that Babylon the Great is fallen. The question, I suppose, is that Rome? Is that New York? Is that Berlin? Is that Mecca? You know, are there any other sort of clues? Well, in Revelation, don't turn there because you should remember this. In Revelation 17:3, it says the harlot, the great city to be found in the desert, in a lonely place, which doesn't really fit Rome or New York. It would fit Mecca, which is in the Arabian desert, in a very lonely place. In 17:5, we saw it's mystery Babylon, not just, you know, the original Babylon. This is a mystery Babylon. The original Babylon is just ruins today. It's in Iraq, about 60 miles south of Baghdad, but nothing there. It's just ruins. So unless this is talking of 100 years from now when it might be rebuilt, there is no Babylon today that could be destroyed because there's nothing there. There's nobody there. And this is mystery Babylon. Okay. Now, if we take the scriptures as a little bit of a jigsaw, we can find a few other clues that might help us identify that this Babylon here is actually to be found in Arabia, as indeed, of course, Mecca is. Let's turn to Isaiah 13. Look at a couple of places in Isaiah that sort of pretty much place Babylon in modern-day Arabia. So Isaiah 13:1 to start with. The burden or prophecy against Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz saw. So this prophecy in this chapter is against Babylon. That's fair enough. Fairly straightforward. Verse 6. Wail, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Verse 9. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel, with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he will destroy its sinners from it. So here's a prophecy against Babylon, but when? Well, the very end. Verse 6 says, the day of the Lord is at hand. Verse 9 says, the day of the Lord comes to lay the land desolate. So we're talking here about the end times. The day of the Lord is literally imminent, and the land of Babylon is going to be destroyed. Of course, you know, the original Babylon isn't there to be destroyed. So is this a different Babylon, perhaps? Mystery Babylon. Look at verses 19 to 22. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. And I think we know that they were overthrown by fire and brimstone out of the sky. And I think we'll see later, when we get back to Revelation 18, that there's going to be, you know, burning fire is going to hit Babylon and burn it, just like is mentioned here. Verse 20, it will never be inhabited, nor will it be settled from generation to generation, nor will the Arabian pitch tents there, nor will the shepherds make their sheepfolds there. Well, hold on a moment. Babylon is going to be destroyed and not inhabited, and the Arabians will not pitch their tents there. Where do we expect Arabians to be? In Arabia. You wouldn't expect Arabians to be pitching their tents in Iraq or Jordan or Israel or Turkey. Arabians pitch their tents. To pitch their tents means to dwell or to reside. So the Arabians will not be pitching their tents there when Babylon is destroyed, because Babylon is in Arabia. Modern prophetic Babylon is in Arabia, where the Arabians are, where they would typically pitch their tents, but not any longer. And if it turns out, a bit of speculation here, ring the old bell, that Mecca, Babylon, the harlot, is destroyed by nuclear weapons, well, that'd be a pretty good reason for not anybody pitching their tents there. If the land is radioactive, like it says in verse 20, it will never be inhabited, nor will it be settled from generation to generation, nor will the Arabians pitch their tents there, nor the shepherds. Well, if it's radioactive, then nobody's going to be there. But notice, it's where the Arabians are. Verse 21, but wild beasts of the desert will lie there. Their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches will dwell there, and wild goats will caper there. The hyenas will howl in their citadels, jackals in their pleasant palaces. Her time is near to come, right at the very end, and her days will not be prolonged. So you can see lots of wild beasts and wild animals around there. But like I said in Revelation 18, the habitation of every unclean bird and foul spirits and demons, it's looks pretty much like these verses here are just describing what we read in Revelation 18, the Babylon destroyed, never inhabited, and the Arabians will no longer pitch their tents there. I mean, if there's any place in Arabia you might want to dwell and reside, it'd be presumably around Mecca. Because after all, you know, that's the capital. That's the heart and soul of your religion. That's the birthplace of Muhammad. That's where the Kaaba is, the Kaaba stone. But no, you won't be pitching your tents there, guys. Or gals. Okay, let's look at Isaiah 21. Isaiah 21. Another prophecy. And read verses 1 and 2. Isaiah 21, 1 and 2. And what we're doing here is this little jigsaw, trying to find references to Babylon in prophecy. I think we should be okay with saying when it mentions Babylon, the Great in Revelation 18:2 and the Mystery of Babylon in Revelation 17:5. It's not talking about the original Babylon because it's all gone. But there are prophecies about the end time that mention Babylon, and where do they place it? Well, they place it where the Arabians would typically pitch their tents, Arabia. But here we are in Isaiah 21, another scripture that sort of points us this direction. Verses 1 and 2, the burden against the wilderness of the sea. Well, the burden or the prophecy against the wilderness of the sea. Where's the wilderness of the sea? If you're reading the King James Version, it says against the desert of the sea. Desert of the sea. What could be the desert of the sea? Who's this prophecy against, in other words? If you're reading the NIV, the Nearly Inspired Version, it says a prophecy against the desert by the sea. So we want a desert, and we want a desert by the sea. Well, it so happens that Saudi Arabia, have a look at a map, easy enough to do with the Google, is bounded on three sides by the sea. On the west, you have the Red Sea. That's a big sea, by the way. Lots of ocean-going vessels sail up and down the Red Sea. On the east, you have the Persian Gulf. And on the south, you have the Arabian Sea. And Arabia itself, of course, is largely desert. There's, I think, just under 1 million square miles of desert. So Arabia is a very large desert country, bounded on three sides by the sea. In fact, in Arabic, most Arabs and Muslims call Arabia Al Jazeera, Al Arabia. Not sure you pronounce that. Al Jazeera, easy enough, A-L hyphen J-A-Z-I-R-A, Al Jazeera, and then Al hyphen Arabia. That's the Arabic for Saudi Arabia, and that simply means Arabian island. So basically, the context of Isaiah 21:1 is the prophecy against Arabia. And the Good News Bible doesn't bother to code things. It just says, the Good News Bible, verse 1, this is a message about Babylonia. They don't mess about with seas and deserts. They just go straight to the punchline. This is a message about Babylonia. Let's read verses 1 and 2 then. The burden against the wilderness or desert of the sea, I'm suggesting, is Saudi Arabia. As whirlwinds in the south pass through, so it comes from the desert, from a terrible land. A distressing vision is declared to me. The treacherous dealer deals treacherously, and the plunderer plunders. Go up, O Elam, besiege, O Media. All its sighing I have made to cease. It's not terribly clear, I've got to say, in the New King James Version, but the Good News Bible translates it this way. This is a message about Babylonia. Like a whirlwind sweeping across the desert, disaster will come from a terrifying land. God will put an end to the suffering which Babylon has caused. Okay, so the prophecy is about Babylon, but it's set in the desert by the sea. And there's probably no better description of the desert by the sea than Saudi Arabia, the Arabian island, Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya. Notice chapter 21, reading verses 9 through 16. So cutting into the prophecy, save a bit of time, it says, and look, here comes a chariot of men with a pair of horsemen. And he answered and said, Babylon is fallen, and all the carved images of her gods he has broken to the ground. Well, that's interesting because that's the verse that Revelation 18, verse 2 quotes. Babylon is fallen. We just read that, Revelation 18. This is the quotation it's taken from. So when we're at the very end of time, just as Jesus is about to return in Revelation 18, when we read of the destruction of Babylon, mystery Babylon, is actually taken from this verse here, verse 9. Dropping down to verse 11, the burden against Duma. He calls to me out of Seir, watchman, what of the night? Watchman, what of the night? What's the news? The watchman said, the morning comes and also the night. If you'll inquire, return, come back. Again, difficult sometimes to quite interpret the whole story there, but notice the reference in verse 11 to Duma and Seir. Well, Duma is, guess where? It's in Arabia. It's near Medina, which is where Muhammad spent most of his time. He was born in Mecca, started his religion in Mecca, but got run out of town, and spent a long time in Medina. And Duma is next to Medina in Arabia. So we're talking about a prophecy against Babylon. Babylon is fallen, is destroyed. But it mentions in conjunction with that, Duma, which is in Arabia. Seir is in part of Arabia. Notice verse 13, the burden of prophecy against Arabia. Sort of get a hint. In the forest in Arabia, you will lodge, O you traveling companies of Dedanites, O inhabitants of the land of Tema, bring water to him who is thirsty. With their bread they met him who fled. Again, just looking at the geography here, this is a prophecy about the fall of Babylon. Babylon, Tema, is in Arabia. Dedan is in Arabia. Drop down to verse 16. For thus the Lord has said to me, within a year, according to the year of our hard man, all the glory of Kedar will fail. Well, where's Kedar? Once again, it's in Arabia. So, trying to put this together, chapter 21 of Isaiah talks about the fall of Babylon, and it mentions over and over again cities in Arabia, and verse 13 says Arabia. So, it does seem, you know, to be pointing towards
Rome.
Babylon is to be found, the Babylon that is fallen, is to be found in the area of Arabia. And additionally, we can find a scripture now that talks about how the Babylon that we're thinking of really is not the original Babylon, that's all ruins now, but is a descendant of Babylon. You might say a daughter of Babylon. Let's turn to Isaiah 47. Isaiah 47, verse 1. Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne. You know, you were enthroned, you were important, but now you're in the dust. No throne. O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called tender and delicate. So here's, in fact, the heading in my Bible says, Destruction of Babylon. That's what they've headed. Chapter 47 is. So this is the destruction of Babylon. Well, there we go. That's what we're looking for. And it says here, sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Well, of course, there are different types of virgins. Paul, writing to the church in Corinth, and 2 Corinthians 11, says, you know, I've betrothed you as a chaste virgin to the Lord. Presumably, therefore, there are unchaste virgins. That's certainly what we're looking at here. Because this is a great harlot. it says, verses 3 through 4, your nakedness shall be uncovered. Yes, your shame will be seen. I will take vengeance. I will not arbitrate with a man. As for our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel. And he's going to bring an end to this virgin daughter of Babylon. This descendant of Babylon. verse 5, sit in silence and go into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no longer be called the Lady of Kingdoms. So that's what she's named herself, been known as, the Lady of Kingdoms. Some translations say the Queen of Kingdoms, the Mistress of Kingdoms, the Queen of Nations. So this virgin daughter of Babylon, this descendant of the original Babylon, but probably bringing quite a number of the same ways of living, the same false teachings, calls herself or has been known as the Queen of Kingdoms, the Queen of Nations. Verse 8 through 11. Therefore, hear this now, you who are given to pleasures, who dwell securely, who say in your heart, I am, and there is no one else besides me. I shall not sit as a widow, nor shall I know the loss of children. So she's not obviously still a virgin because she's got children. And she'll never be a widow because must be a husband of some sort. And she's proud and arrogant. And she'll never fall. Verse 9, but these two things shall come to you in a moment, in one day. The loss of children and widowhood. They shall come upon you in their fullness because of the multitude of your sorceries, for the great abundance of your enchantments. And we'll see, we'll go back to Revelation 18, reference to one day, to sorceries, to enchantments, to a queen, to widowhood. So Revelation 18 is really probably just, taking from this chapter. Verse 10, for you have trusted in your wickedness, you have said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge have warped you, and you've said in your heart, I am, and there's no one else besides me. Therefore evil or calamity shall come upon you. You shall not know from where it arises, and we do, it's from the ten nations. And trouble shall fall upon you. You will not be able to put it off, and desolation, destruction shall come upon you suddenly, which you shall not know or, I guess, understand. So here's the queen or mistress of nations, a daughter or descendant of ancient Babylon, who will fall in one day and become a widow and childless. Now, who can this be? Who is this daughter of Babylon? Let's turn back to Revelation 18, read verses 4 to 8. You see, virtually is a parallel. Revelation 18, verses 4 through 8 should make, I think, almost perfect sense now. I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, unless you receive of her plagues, her destruction, for her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Render to her just as she rendered to you. Repay her double according to her works in the cup which she has mixed. Mix for her double, this city, this harlot, this Babylon, in the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow, for she says in her heart, I sit as queen and am no widow and will not see sorrow. Well, we just read that. Isaiah 47, the queen of the nations, who says, I'll never lose my children. I'll never experience widowhood. But she does. For therefore, verse 8, her plagues will come in one day. Just like Isaiah 47 said. It's the same story. Her plagues will come in one day. Now that could just be, sort of a poetic way of saying a very short time. But equally, knowing today's modern weaponry, powerful missiles, plenty of them, a nuke or two, that wouldn't take more than an hour or two. So this could well be literally one day. Therefore, verse 8, her plagues will come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she'll be utterly burned with fire. For strong is the Lord who judges her. So utterly burned with fire. I don't know, is that nukes? Could be. There's a hint that some countries in the Islamic realm may have some nukes or be working pretty hard to get them. Anyway, moving on, let's read verses 9 through to 19, verse 3. So we'll just run through this. I don't think there's a huge amount necessarily to say. In explanation, the narrative is relatively straightforward from now on. The kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city, Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come." This great city, Babylon, this great harlot, I'm suggesting Mecca, her judgment has come, and she's burning. And, Saudi Arabia has huge amounts of oil, oil wells. If you set, fires burning in Saudi Arabia, you're going to get, pitch and tar and oil and huge clouds of smoke burning across the entire landscape. You might remember in the Gulf War that Saddam Hussein set fire to some oil fields, and you just got, scores and scores of huge, massive burning clouds of fire. That's sort of what's implied here. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen and purple, silk and scarlet, every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object of most precious wood, bronze, iron and marble. So no longer will the extremely wealthy Saudis, the 15,000 members of the royal family, who you'll see photographs today of sports cars made of gold and impregnated with diamonds and pearls. I mean, it's almost obscene, excessive luxury. But, of course, no longer. They can't buy any longer. There's no money any longer. They're gone. Carrying on, verse 13, and they won't be buying, verse 13, cinnamon and incense, fragrant oil and frankincense, wine and oil, fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots, and notice, and bodies and souls of men. So what's this? This Babylon the Great, this harlot, buys all sorts of luxury items and buys the bodies and souls of men? Is this slavery? The answer is, looks like it. If you're buying people, then you're buying slaves. And strangely enough, the Quran permits Muslims to hold slaves. So this is another little neat sort of almost, little clue that we're talking about Islam. People talk about religion of peace. That's really not accurate. Here's two or three quotations here about slavery and Islam. The first quote is from a guy called Sheikh Salih Al-Fawzan. His name is not too important, but this is who he is. He's a member of the Senior Council of Clerics, Saudi Arabia's highest religious body. So since we're talking about Saudi here, here's a guy who is a member of the Senior Council of Religious Clerics in Saudi Arabia. And this is a quote from 2003, not that far back. And he says, quotes, "Slavery is a part of Islam. Slavery is part of jihad. And jihad will remain as long as there is Islam." He continues, "Those who argue that slavery has been abolished are ignorant, not scholars. They are merely writers. Whoever says such things is an infidel." So you see, this senior cleric in Saudi Arabia's most senior religious body says slavery is part of Islam. It's part of jihad. When you go out and wage jihad with the sword, who you capture becomes your slave. Here's a quotation from the New York Post, 2002. Slavery still exists in a host of majority Muslim countries, especially Sudan and Mauritania, also Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And here's one from a guy called Robert Spencer, who I've heard a few of his videos, bit of an expert on Islam, and he says, quotes, besides being practiced more or less openly today in Sudan and Mauritania, there is evidence that slavery still continues beneath the surface in some majority Muslim countries as well, notably Saudi Arabia, which only abolished slavery in 1962, and I won't. What he means there is, it's been abolished, but, you know, under the radar, it's still happening. He says, it continues in Yemen and Oman, both of which ended legal slavery in 1970, and Niger, which didn't abolish slavery till 2004. In Niger, the ban is widely ignored, and as many as 1 million people remain in bondage. Slaves are bred, often raped, and generally treated like animals, end quote. So that's just a taste that actually slavery is perfectly acceptable in Islamic theology. Muhammad had slaves. He raped female slaves. He beat slaves. The Quran, the word of Allah, says it's okay to have slaves. So therefore, if you believe in the Quran, the example of Muhammad, the perfect example, you may keep slaves. So getting back to verse 13 here, interesting that the reference to this harlot, this great city, Babylon, which I'm suggesting may well be Mecca, the heart and soul of Islam, and of course Saudi Arabia, where it appears that slavery still is happening somewhat behind the scenes, it's going to happen again. It refers to buying the bodies and souls of men. And the fruit, verse 14, that your soul longed for has gone from you, and all the things which are rich and splendid have gone from you. You shall find them no more at all. The merchants of these things, who became rich by her, you know, you offer oil to get huge amounts of money and merchandise and import all these luxury items. You don't make too many in a desert country, but you can import them from all around the world, places like Harrods and so on. The merchants of these things, verse 15, who became rich by her, will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing and saying, alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. For in 1 hour, such great riches came to nothing. And every shipmaster, all who travel by ship, sailors, and as many as trade in the sea, stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what is like this great city? Well, if it's Mecca we're on about, you can do that from ships and vessels in the Red Sea. It's not too far from the Red Sea to Mecca. If she's on fire, smoke billowing up and burning, perhaps after a nuke has been detonated over her, then the sailors, the merchantmen from their ships in the Red Sea can easily see it. Verse 19, and they threw dust on their heads and cried out, weeping and wailing, and saying, alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth. For in 1 hour, she's made desolate. And of course, the disgusting thing here is that despite the appalling behavior of this great city and her harlotry and her illicit relationships and her excessive luxury and her decadence and her false teaching, the many nations were quite prepared to accept all that because of the money you can make. Verse 20, rejoice over her, O heaven, and you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her. Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found any more. The sound of harpists, musicians, flutists, and trumpeters shall not be heard in you any more, and no craftsman of any craft shall be found in you any more, and the sound of a millstone shall not be heard in you any more, and the light of a lamp shall not shine in you any more, and the voice of bridegroom and bride shall not be heard in you any more. For your merchants were the great men of the earth, for by your sorcery all the nations were deceived, and in her was found the blood of prophets and saints and of all who were slain on the earth. It says in verse 23 there, for your merchants were the great men of the earth. Again, that's got to be prime ministers, presidents, CEOs of international corporations. Deceived, seduced, blinded by the money and the wealth, and quite prepared to compromise their principles. So, that's a sort of an overview of chapters 17 and 18. Chapter 17, again, describes a harlot and the beast she rides. Chapter 18 there describes her destruction, her judgment. And hopefully, if nothing else, we can be familiar with the narrative. You know, what does it say? And then, of course, we're around to what do you think it means? And obviously, you've got a few options here. It could be, of course, talking of the Catholic Church, the Vatican, you know, riding a united Europe of 10 nations led by Germany. I think you're familiar with that option. Don't think it works very well, but that's an option. Some people believe that this is referring to a one-world religion of the end time, ruling over 10 divisions of planet Earth. And what we've been suggesting here is that this could well be Islam, and particular Mecca, riding over the 10 Islamic nations who unite in the resurrected Islamic Empire. So, could be perhaps any of those. But I've got a favourite out of those three. You can probably guess which it is. Okay, we're in Revelation, so let's have a look at Revelation 6. Not going to get too far today, I don't suppose, but it'll set us up for next week, because Revelation 6, we might be fairly familiar with this. It's the six seals of the scroll that Jesus opened. You know, remember the first four seals are also the four horsemen of the Acropolis, or actually the Apocalypse. And we're not going to delve too deeply into this, but I suppose one of the questions I'm going to ask and hopefully answer is, would these six seals in Revelation chapter 6, would they fit neatly into an Islamic end-time sort of view? You know, we've probably had an explanation that sort of vaguely, sort of, but not very well, fits Rome and Europe. But if we said the Islamic Empire seemed like quite a plausible way forward, would these six seals, would the four horsemen of the apocalypse, would they fit, do you think? Because obviously everything should fit together, you know, fairly well. If something doesn't really fit, we've got something wrong somewhere. So let's read Revelation 6, 1-8, and we might get through perhaps one horse before the race finishes. We'll do the four horsemen first. That's verses 1-8. Now I saw when the Lamb Jesus opened one of the seals on this rolled up scroll that was sealed with, you know, all these seals. So you have to sort of tear one off and open the scroll up, tear one off and open the scroll up further and see what's inside. I heard one of the four living creatures sing with a voice like thunder, come and see. And I looked, and behold, a white horse. And he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. So a white horse, and one who goes out conquering. He has a bow and he has a crown. Verses 3 and 4. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, "Come and see," and another horse, fiery red, went out. It was granted to the one who sat on it to take peace from the earth, and that people should kill one another. And it was given to him a great sword. So a fiery horse, fiery red horse. Verse 5 and 6. When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come and see." And I looked, and behold, a black horse. And he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine." Curious. And then the fourth of the four horsemen. When he opened the fourth seal, I heard a voice of the fourth living creature saying, "Come and see." I looked and behold, a green horse. And it's green. Covered that already. It's chloros. It's a green horse, not pale horse. It's a green horse, like green grass, like green foliage, like green trees. It's green. I looked and behold, a green horse. And the name of him who sat on it was Death. And Hades, or the grave, followed with him. And power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill, some at least, with sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth. And there's a fifth seal and a sixth seal.
There you go.
So the question is going to be, if we feel that the Islamic Empire end time explanation sort of seems to work, how would these six seals fit in? Well, in the sort of 3 or 4 minutes we got left, the best we can do is just touch briefly at least on the first horse. I'll sort of show you the idea. Verse 2, I looked and behold a white horse. He who sat on it had a bow, a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. Well, I think we probably all accept that the white horse pictures false religion. You know, Jesus comes on a white horse at the end of the book of Revelation, but that's not what we're looking at here. I think we're all probably fairly relaxed about the white horse is picturing one who goes out with false religion to deceive on a massive scale. And probably in the past we might have thought this is going to be maybe the Pope going out deceiving people with Catholicism and some variation on a theme. Okay, this is an easy one. It's simply Islam. The one on the white horse is simply, or the white horse is simply the picture of the false religion of Islam going out conquering and to conquer. Mohammed he's got 201 names apparently. A little bit greedy for fame. But he has 201 names, one of which is the crown, or possessor of the crown. So it'd be fairly easy to say here that actually, if the white horse pictures a religion which goes out and captures people for the devil effectively, then wow, Islam, a really nice fit. Because 1.67 billion people conquered for Allah or Satan. All 1.67 billion hold to the spirit of Antichrist and deny the Father, deny the Son, deny Jesus. They really are deceived. And Mohammed, their perfect example, is known as the crown or the possessor of the crown. So it's quite easy to see the white horse as being nothing other than Islam on the march, and perhaps particularly at the end of time. Oh, I think we've got time perhaps for the red horse, making the most of the last few minutes. In verse 4, another horse, fiery red, went out, and it was granted to the one who sat on it to take peace. That can be peace of mind and security, by the way. It doesn't necessarily mean full-blown war, but that's probably going to be a large part of it. The one who was sat on the red horse was granted to take peace from the earth and that people should kill one another, and it was given to him a great sword. Well, now, if we're talking of the Islamic empires, and particularly in the end time, ever heard of the Sword of Islam? The Sword of Jihad? Because jihad means struggle, but the main struggle is a struggle against unbelievers to conquer the whole world in the name of Allah. Like we said before, if you start round about Muhammad's day, then Islam has killed something like 270 million people with the sword of jihad. And there's more to come. There's more killing to come. More martyrdom to come. More destruction to come. As if the Islamic Empire is healed and returns, then yep, it is going to be given a great sword. The sword of Islam, the sword of jihad, to kill and certainly take security from the earth. So actually, thinking of Islam as the end-time fulfillment, the white horse, piece of cake. The red horse, spot on. Okay, I guess we can't look at the black horse. Pity, because there's an interesting little bit in there, but that will wait for next week. So let's conclude today's Bible study at that point.